Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am really excited to have with me my good friend, Suki Fuller. Suki is founder and analytical storyteller at Mirabeau, providing growth and strategic intelligence integration to businesses throughout Europe, and is co-founder and senior VP Europe of DC Analytics, an open source intelligence consulting company. She sits on the advisory board of Tech London Advocates and co-leads TLA's Women in Tech and Global Tech Advocates Black Women in Tech working groups. An advisor, non-executive director, and board member to multiple startups, Suki is currently immersed in the world of security tech. Suki, really great to have you here with me today. Thank you so much for joining.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. And by the way, Arish, that is safety tech, not security tech. But you can say safety. I mean, I always say safety tech should be at the top of the umbrella and everything falls underneath. So security's in there.
Well, no doubt we will get into that, right? So you and I have actually known each other for some time, but you're going to have to tell me, like, what exactly is an analytical storyteller? And Why are they even important?
Well, I always tell people that analytical storyteller is basically the combination of the quantitative and the qualitative parts of analysis. So with the quantitative, you have your sort of your data and your logic. And the qualitative, you have your human side. So I tell people, I tell the story of data. I help to mitigate risks and build resilience with companies by making sure they understand both sides of the story. And that's what analytical storytelling is.
So to dig into that a little bit more, right? So effectively, you take the data that companies produce and allow them to use it to tell a story about what their growth potential of, you know, their customer's journey. What is it exactly that you're telling stories about, I guess? You know, because it's one thing to kind of have some data and you can make up kind of a narrative around any data, but surely there has to be a purpose to that narrative ultimately, right?
Yeah, so basically from the beginning of my career, when you think of, I always tell people, you know, analytical storying, it's really about competitive intelligence, strategic intelligence. It's about helping people to make the best competitive advantage for their company, their business, themselves even. So it is sometimes taking data that companies have already harvested, that they've already gathered. Sometimes it is helping them to figure out what they want to gather. Because sometimes we know people's have a lot of stuff. They have a lot of information that they don't need. There's a lot of junk out there. So you have to really wade through it, parse through it, and organize it in a way that you say, well, this is good. This can go in a maybe later box. This goes in a never box. And this is what we actually need. So it's about identifying what exactly you are looking for, then actually finding it, making sure you bring in some other pieces, because sometimes we find those white spaces, and I am all about the white space. That's actually my specialty, is I can help you with the obvious question and getting to the end, but sometimes there's white space that you don't really recognize, and it's saying, hey, your idea is really great, but this looks like it could potentially be a lot more financially more advantageous for you to go this way. It is the quintessential pivot in tech speak, but it really is about competitiveness and strategic advantage, making sure that you position yourself in the right place to make sure you're able to grow, make sure you're able to do better things, and of course do good, because I'm all about doing good.
That's super interesting. And one of the things you said there, which I think is really particularly important, is that concept of white spaces, right? Where it's what the data isn't telling you, or what the data that you don't have rather than the data that you do have. Because, you know, often it's very easy to get kind of tunnel vision. And I've seen this in a lot of the ventures that I've worked with. You fixate on, you know, one or two or even several pieces of data or data points, and you use those as your North Star. to the extent that you ignore kind of what you aren't being told, right? And often I think, you know, this is true in life as much as it is in tech and venture. It's often what you're not hearing that is as important than what you are hearing, or what you don't know is as important as what you do know, right? Because only in exploring those spaces where of information that you don't know do you get the insights to do something differently and potentially, you know, grow bigger and better than you would have otherwise, right? So you said earlier, right, and thank you for the correction, you know, you work in the world of safety tech, not security tech. So can you talk us through what you're doing and why it's so important today, especially in the context of everything that's going on around us?
Technically, competitive intelligence is security tech, but I always think that when people think of security and they think of cybersecurity in particular, they always think of files and data. They never think of the people aspect. And as I said, I'm an analytical storyteller. I tell both sides. So there is the data side, which is where most banks and businesses will focus on. But there is also the people side, and that's where safety tech really comes in. Safety tech is about protecting the human experience online. And it is very much the things that you do in the IRL, real life, quote unquote. I hate that term, but it's the one that everybody knows. So the things that people do in the physical world, where it's tangible and you can touch and you can feel that, they should also be punished for those things that they do in that real world, in the online world, if it is negative. So if you are out here harassing somebody, verbally harassing somebody on your street, and you're calling names at them across the street, you would be prosecuted for that. When you go online, it should be the same way. And this is what right now, I believe today, actually, the last measures of the online harms bill has actually gone before Parliament. And that will really mean that tech companies will be held accountable for what happens on their platforms, because they should already have some of these measures in place. There should be clear outlines and guidances stipulating what is and what is not acceptable behavior on a website. Once that is established, if somebody violates that rule, then you as the tech provider, the tech company, are able to actually legally remove them and say you have broken the rules, instead of having these ambiguous rules around, well, we have to decide at that specific time what the decision is going to be. No, if you have it from the onset, there's a clear line. There's no gray area. And right now we're really very much operating in the gray. And unfortunately, in this world of tech, we are seeing that we do have a lot of gray. We're unable to actually protect people in the physical world. So I'm always wondering how we're going to do that in the online world, because we barely got a grip of this in Web 2.0. We're in Web 3 right now. Web 3 is coming. We've got the metaverse. We've got, you know, the world of XR, VR, MR. And so those environments are going to be specifically more acute for people. And when things start to feel like they are more like you're in the physical world, I'm just seeing there's so many different possibilities of what can be good, but also at the same time, what can be bad. And that's usually the intersection of where I sit. It's about mitigating the risk. So it's about the clear appreciation for the opportunities, but at the same time, recognizing with those opportunities, there does come threats, and being aware and being able to navigate through what the potential disasters could be and what the potential great opportunities and just the great build that can happen for technology. Sorry, I just waxed on there for a few minutes.
That's okay. I mean, actually, whilst you're talking, it's very timely. I read an article just yesterday, and I was just trying to dig it out, but I'll see if I can find it to put in the show notes. But it was around a lady who had been harassed in the metaverse, right? So she had been groped whilst in the metaverse. But of course, there are no rules, exactly to your point, around what is the legality of someone being harassed, physically molested, let's say, in the metaverse, because it is their avatar being molested, not them, potentially, is the argument I would see, some people making. Whereas obviously the obvious argument, counter argument, is that, well, actually, that they are still, harassing her as an individual or as a person. And it went way beyond there, right? Like, what are the rights of a citizen or a denizen of the metaverse, right? Am I allowed to enter the metaverse as a transgender person or as a white person with blue eyes or someone who doesn't look like me or doesn't have my identity attached to my, as you said, IRL, in real life identity? And what are the connotations and what are the implications of that? And I think these are all massively important questions that we're going to be answering, I don't think anytime soon, but just in a very ongoing manner, because we still haven't, as you said, we still haven't figured out, how to regulate Web 2.0 necessarily to the best, to the best outcomes for the greater good.
Yeah, I do really wonder about the ownership of identity as we move forward in the sort of the Web 3.0 space. And it's one of those questions you're constantly asking, because right now people, you have what are deemed as keyboard warriors that, come out with their avatar, which looks completely different than who they are. And so...
Or may even be a board ape. Or a completely fictional
character.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so there is now just the question of, How do you ascribe identity to somebody in that space? And I don't know how that's one of those questions. That's one of those big thought processes and big, it's something that is being discussed in the space right now, because there has to be. And while everybody says, ultimately, we want everything to be decentralized, there is absolutely no way that everything can be decentralized, because in being decentralized, you actually are centralizing. It's sort of one of those, it's a very circular way of thinking about it, but it is. And in order for that to be attained, it's not possible, because then there would be no protections. And there has to be protections, because as we see, yeah, you can be groped in the metaverse, and there are harms that can happen to people. There's psychological harm, and everybody's talking about how the metaverse is supposed to be a safer place for people, when in fact, unfortunately, sorry, skeptic, it's human nature. There is always going to be people that want to do good in this world. And that's the majority of people. They just want to live their lives, be good at what they're doing, raise their families, be a good person. And there are people that always want to take advantage of those bad. Those bad people will always want to take advantage of the good people. So, and that is just the human nature. That's the yin and the yang, the good and the bad. And unfortunately, we will have that, and we will see more of it in the metaverse, I think, a lot faster than you do in Web 2.0. It's taken a long time for Web 2.0 to get as sufficiently bad as it is. I mean, it probably started happening maybe 10, 15 years ago, I would say. Unfortunately, Twitter, sorry, with your growth expansion in, the early 2010s, I'd say that's pretty much when it started getting particularly bad. It existed before in games, but not as bad. And now it's metaverse opens, it's there on day one. It's not even there on like day one. It's like it's there before they've even started. And that,
well, I mean, The people building Web 3.0, yeah, they are used to this current environment of Web 2, but like that is the normality. So you would build from what is normal rather than potentially kind of reinvent. And I think to your point, like Twitter today is rife with fake accounts and bots and obviously very, very, trolls that are there particularly to you know, encourage conflict and encourage bad actors. I can't see how by removing someone's personal identity in the metaverse, that's going to get any better. As you say, that likely is just going to make it worse, right?
No, and it's like you want to have protections in place for people. So you want to have the opportunity and the ability to anonymize for people that need to be protected, that, you know, whistleblowers or political dissidents. You know, we've seen what's happened to people in the current environment that have spoken out against their governments or against organizations. But at the same time, you have to weigh up the possibilities that there are people that are going to take advantage of that situation and just basically be going to spilling rubbish. And it's that age-old question of, do you make laws to protect, or are you making laws to just pretty much blanket everybody? And that's sort of the way with sort of the whole national security bills and security bills that say, well, you know, we're just going to stick a camera up here and we're going to surveil everybody in order to protect and find a few people. And it's like, well, actually, no, because then you're just taking a whole bunch of people's data and you're putting them in a box. Do you need that? You don't need that. It's absolutely unnecessary. But the argument is always going to be, we're doing it to protect you. And people won't argue against that. And this is one of the issues that I'm constantly in conflict with myself about. It's like you want to protect everybody, but at the same time, you realize by doing that, you are putting everybody in this box. And that's not necessarily the correct way. It's not the correct way.
Yeah, and I think the corollary over the last couple of years has obviously been sort of around COVID, where obviously fairly fit and healthy individuals have sacrificed potentially their freedoms for those that are more vulnerable than themselves. And I would hope that most of us would have done that voluntarily and without comment or cause for concern. But there has been a vocal minority, I would say, that even found that too restrictive on their freedom. So I completely subscribe to that duality of conflict where, like, obviously I want to make sure that online spaces are healthy environments for everyone. And, you know, when I think about it in terms of my younger children and nieces and nephews and so on. And I worry about the level of kind of, debate and conflict that they see online and some of the nastier sort of areas of the internet that they maybe get exposed to and through the most normal of apps, right? Like, so whether that's, you know, Instagram or Facebook or TikTok or Snapchat or any of the others. But equally, I absolutely don't want their data being harvested by all and sundry. And I certainly don't think that the government need to be knowing everything about, you know, what my children are doing. So I think this is one of those debates that's going to continue, as you say, for quite some time, because it comes back to rights of the individual versus rights of the many, right? And I think if the platforms did more voluntarily to police and restrict bad behavior and bad actors, I think you would probably see less need for regulation or less call for regulation than what you do at the moment, which is, well, okay, those platforms seem to be running amok. And you know, I think that's a point of view rather than an absolute truth. Because they're running amok, you see governments trying to legislate them or regulate them as much as possible. And obviously Europe is at the forefront of that regulation.
Yeah, and what I think is really scary is that while you have the government saying, oh, we want to police this, the government itself does not have the technological talent internally. One, because they don't actually consider it that much of a priority to pay people at the same level that private corporations do. And if they did, they would be able to get the talent, retain the talent, and that talent would then grow and be able to recruit more talent. But because they'll take people at a earlier stage, and once those people get enough experience, they'll leave because the pay and the actual appreciation for what you do is more outside of the government. And that is across the board, unless, unfortunately, you are private corporations and you are working for the government, as normally happens. You know, I have a school mate who couldn't get a job directly out of university working for government organizations. One, he did hack some places, but that was the talent that actually was needed. And so he didn't get a government job. He went and worked in private industry. And now government organizations pay the company that he works for to do the same work that had they just paid him originally, he would have been quite willing to do for the government because he really wanted to work in the government.
So that's like white hat hackers, I guess, as opposed to black hat.
Yeah.
Right? So and they end up in places like Palantir or I guess Halliburton or other agencies that certainly in the US at the very least kind of I don't know what the equivalence of those are here in the UK. Albeit that I did see again recently that Palantir has won a contract, I think, to reduce inefficiencies in the NHS.
Yeah.
So it looks like we're going down that path here in the UK as well.
It's not even a matter of going down that path. It's already, we've been down that path. That's where you have government contractors that are just super, super huge, winning these contracts and doing basically and essentially the same thing externally that the government is trying to do internally. So we're like subsidizing the private sector, and it's in areas where they had enough time to build up the talent. And this is one of the areas where I really am actually really excited about the safety tech area, because the companies that are working in safety tech, they're basically, their whole mission is, wait a minute. And a lot of these were people that started out as activists, or they were younger and they saw things that were going on. They said, wait a minute, that's not healthy. I shouldn't be going online and having this problem. And they've started their companies combating and fighting that and protecting children online and making sure that, you know, people aren't stealing your identity. This one blows my mind constantly. I've done a talk and I show people about the life of data and how that affects what's happening in your life, what's going to happen in your life 10 years from now. And I show that this baby that was born on 9/11 in like everybody at 9/11 at 9/11 on, it was like, it was one of those like trifectas, you know, born at 9/11 on 9/11, you know, at weighing 9 pounds, 11 ounces. It was like, whoa, how did this happen? And the media so put out so much information. They knew the parents' names, the parents' full names. So you already have the time and date of birth. You already have the hospital. You had the name of the nurse and the doctor that were there. You have the parents' full names. You know the town that they live in. So this baby's whole piece of any digital information, any data about that baby was known before that kid even got out the hospital.
Yeah, their digital footprint is already like well and truly.
Yeah, so anybody wants to, you know, design a whole personality around that particular baby, they've already got it. They've already decided, based on your parents, based on what your parents do, where you live, everything, where you may potentially go to school, where you may potentially, you know, what you might potentially earn, where you're going to eat, where you're going to shop. Somebody's already built a whole marketing personality around that, one. And then two, there are those bad actors that will say, hey, you know what? We have this already. We can just, you know, build a whole person. That will be, that person can be perfectly brilliant, but they will also have that dark actor acting as them somewhere else.
Yeah, they'll have like a shadow.
Yeah, it's like good devil and, you know, bad devil.
I mean, so you were talking about talent earlier, right? You were one of 2021's most influential women in UK tech, according to Computer Weekly. I mean, how have things improved for women in technology over the 15 plus years you've been in the sector? And what lessons have we still not learned? And I know this could be a long one.
Well, I'm sure you have seen a statistic that 1% of VC funding goes to female founders. 1%. That number used to be 2%. It dropped. One of the things that is really frustrating is that everybody thinks if you throw money into a D&I, and I hate that term also, initiative, if you say, oh, hey, you know, we're a fund and we're going to fund female founders and we're going to help them, that is actually going to minimize the problem. And we all know that's BS. Doesn't happen that way. You can't just say, hey, you know what, we're going to give you some candy. It's like, no. That person needs to be in the manufacturing, sitting there making the decisions about what you're putting in the candy. They need to be there when you're building the building to, you know, decide what type of candy you're going to make. You have to have the people at the table, and women have to be at the table. It can't be male VCs with one or two female partners going, oh, hey, you know, we're going to help some women, and we're going to help them by giving them, you know, a measly couple million dollars or million pounds, whereas you gave some guy 50 billion or 50 million because he wrote on a napkin and that woman came in with a perfectly perfectly thought out business plan and pitch deck, but, you know, you still asked her male co-founder the questions. But anyways, let me not rant anymore. I will just say,
no.
I will rant, but, you know, anyways, moving on. How has it improved? And how, I would say, from when I first entered the sector, I started out my career in chemical engineering. So I was electroplating ferrous and non-ferrous metals. And I, long story short, was not really liking that career. I was the first woman in the company that I worked for, the first female to be an electroplater, the first female to work on any of the aerospace parts. I was the first female. And then to be a black female, I was the first black female. I was the first black person. So that's fine. You know, company actually treated me pretty well, had a great foreman, a great, you know, manager, VP of the company, great company, but it was not what I wanted to do. So then when I got the degree in intelligence studies and I went into the intelligence degree, you know, basically you're taught to be an analyst from the day go. You are taught the analytical process. You are basically taught to think like an analyst, to breathe like an analyst, but you get practical experience also. That was the great thing about my university program. Shout out Mercyhurst University. Woo, woo. And we learned that at the very beginning. So when you go out into the field and you're out in the sector, you do see that there is a difference. Being a black female, not very many black females working either in national security or in private sector when I first started out. And I did my stint in all of them. But then when you work heavily in the tech sector as an intelligence analyst, you see even less. But then when you're working in the private sector, in the competitive intelligence field as a private sector person, you see even less. And when you are seeing even less women, when you're working with venture funds or working with tech companies, I think for some people is disheartening. For me, it's almost wasn't disheartening. I'm extremely competitive. I was the only girl in my family for the first 7 years of my life. So I had no female cousins or anything. It was me and a bunch of boys. And so you're the person that has to be in goal because they don't want you to play football. You can only be in the goal so they can kick the ball at you. So, you know, when you're playing cricket, baseball, whatever, you are always the person that's in the defensive position. So I think for me, it was just a matter of, okay, I'm going to have to play with the boys. I don't have to be a boy, but I have to make sure that I know how to handle the boy. And for me, I always think of men as boys with gray hair. That's always my analogy when I am having to deal with anybody in any situation. Even if they don't have gray hair, I'm just like, you know what? You're just a bigger boy. And that's, you know, they always say you should look at someone and think of them naked. I don't. I look at them and I think, you're just a bigger boy. You just have more money and maybe you have bigger toys, you know. But either way, I look at it like that. So I could see how it can be disheartening, can be discouraging, because you are always constantly having to go uphill. And even when you think you've gotten to the top of the hill, you realize, oh, you're not at the top. You know, we have these lists of the most influential women in tech. But then when you compare that to just the most influential people in tech, you'll see that maybe there's not a woman even in the top 50. And so it's like, it's really great to know that I have these other women that, yeah, I'm being compared to, but there is really no comparison. We're all different. But then when you can put it into the bigger picture, and I'm always looking at the bigger strategic picture, we're still not there.
It's almost like throwing a sop, right? It's sort of like, okay, we know we need to performatively show that, you know, we're thinking about this issue, and therefore we'll carve out this unique kind of cohort, and, you know, we'll showcase that cohort, which I think is important. But to your point, like if you're not showing up in the bigger list, if you're not kind of at the table in a bigger way, then it's almost slightly dismissive. It's sort of like, we've given you your trophy, we've included in your list, it's okay, that's fine, right? But, you know, this is the main one that we really care about. And I think what's really interesting to me at the moment, you know, as you said at the beginning, the 2% went to 1%. I think so much ink has been spilt, so many words have been said around diversity in tech, in venture, but the change really has to come right from the top. And I think I've said this many times on this podcast before. If you aren't bringing in a more diverse set of LPs, funding more diverse GPs in venture, who are then, you know, investing in diverse founders, who are then building diverse teams and then recycling that. And I think the key is that recycling element, right, of making sure that capital and that growth and that value that's created through that process is recycled back into the ecosystem. You don't see enough of it. And I think, you know, I recorded a pod with Nee Clellan some time ago, during the pod, I think we were talking about the fact that only 38 black founders had been funded in the UK, like in the 10 years up to 2019. And that to me is just an absolutely ludicrous, you know, incredibly disheartening and ludicrous statistic to have to face up to. But at least it's a statistic that we know that we need to face up to, at least at the very least, those of us that care know that it needs to be dealt with. And I think all we can do is continue. Well, not all we can do, but one of the things we can do is definitely keep on banging the drum and making sure that those, that it is understood that that is not acceptable.
Yeah. You know, I always find just, so like we have day before yesterday, I can't remember, was the gender pay gap day. And for men and women. And what I find highly ironic is gender pay gap there is actually the average. So it's the average for all women. And when you actually break down the numbers for, say, as a black woman, I know this number. So if you break it down for a black woman, the gender pay gap, we are September 21st is when we actually would be earning the same as a male on average. So when you think of...
What does that mean, like September 21st? What do you mean by
so that? It would take us until September 21st to be earning the same. It would to basically be closing the gap on how much we earn compared to the average man. So I can't remember what day it was this week. I want to say it was maybe Monday or I don't know. I can't remember. But
yeah, it may have been Monday.
Either way, excuse me, for a female to be earning the same as a man on average, it will take from the beginning of the year until this past Monday or whatever day it was to be earning the same as a man. So pound for pound. And for a black female to be earning the same as a white male, pound for pound, it would be September 21st. So basically, pretty much the whole year until I would be earning the same as a white male or a man in general. I'm not sure. They do the average, but the average, if you look at it statistically, it would be a white male.
Yeah, I mean, I think... This is the problem with averages, right? Like, it's a bit like talking about venture capital in averages. You've got to look at the median or the
The point I was going to make. When we do have these lists where we put people on, we are looking at an average. So you have your average top 50 women in tech, and then you look at your average top 50 men in tech, and those women are still below the average that you consider average for men, because they haven't, we haven't been paid the same, we haven't been recognized the same, we've never gotten that funding, we're not even considered for those same jobs. So it is, it's not an, the scale is just not equal. And before you even can try to make the scale equal, you need to make the base equal. And we're not even there, you know, we are not there at all, not in any way, shape or form. If a venture fund says, oh yeah, we're going to have more female partners, they bring in one female partner who probably intersects two things for them. It may be a black female, because then they've got a black person, because generally they might not have one, and then they've got a female. Or they'll bring in somebody who may be, you know, of Asian descent. And it's like, oh, well, you know, you're an ethnic minority. Although I'm still going to point it out, and I point it out every time, you are not an ethnic minority. We are actually majorities. We are just a minority in certain countries. But if you look at global population, we rule. But, sorry, let me raise my fist there. but when you look at those, just the way that it weighs up, it really needs to be, you can't just bring one person in and then expect that person to fix it, because it usually does. Companies do it all the time. They bring in one person, they then throw all the weight of all their diversity and inclusion issues on that one person, in addition to their regular job, in addition to anything externally where they want to put a face on it. They put that person on their magazine. Oh, look, we have a black person that works there. Oh, look, that person's also in charge of our D&I initiative, as well as being, you know, the CTO, as well as being the person that they're going to send out and speak at every single event during Black History Month or during Women's International Month. And that they're going to put on all their little recruiting magazines. It blows the mind. I'm sorry. I'm really annoyed and upset that this is still something we have to navigate. And the problem is, I think there's a lot of us. I know there are a lot of us that work in technology that are women, that are Black women. And it is not just Black women or Asian women, or it is all the women. All the women. I was recently at an event and I'm speaking to all, and they're just like, you know what? I'm really sick of this. And it's gotten to the point where, and I think maybe the pandemic pushed it over. Before, people were sick of it, and I think people were still sort of hand-holding, you know, accepting, you know, like, oh, you know, we've got to come a long way. Now people are just like, you know what? For 2 years, you've had to deal with some of the same issues that we as women have had to deal with, working from home, helping with our families full-time while we're working. And now it's like, okay, you see how it's done. You can do it. Guess what? We definitely want our flowers now, you know? It's like, show me the money, show me the green, you know, show me the plastic, whatever, you know, pay up. And we definitely want the recognition, and we want people to say action. Action speaks louder than words. And right now we've been having too many words, too many initiatives, too many drives. I quite frankly am sick of an initiative. You know, I'll participate, but generally when I'm participating, I will say these same words. Initiative is great. I need to see action. And it's not action that is just action that goes away after a few months, that action that happens in March because it's International Women's Day. You know, it's not action that happens on one day. You know, gender pay gap, BOP. Gotta give a shout out to you. That was probably the best thing that happened on International Women's Day on Twitter, was that bot. Every time a company put that hashtag in their tweet, that bot was tweeting out the pay gap in that particular company. If that company had 250 people registered, 250 people employed, and they were registered on the government website where they reported, that pay gap bot was tweeted out. And that's what I want to see. I think now is the time when we actually need to start naming companies. I don't know, naming and shaming. I don't think shaming is naming and shaming. But I think that by naming companies, it holds them accountable. It's not a matter of shaming them. It's just accountability. Because too long we've been sort of shrouded in this veil of silence. And when you perpetuate that, that is how things continue. It's just like with child abuse and with everything. People, by staying silent, you actually are being complicit. And I think we as women, by staying silent and allowing companies to continually do this because we think it's protecting ourselves and others, that we are basically going along with it. And it's time to just say, you know what? No, I'm sorry. I can't do that. And when people ask you, now when people ask me, like, who was that company you were talking about? I will tell them. Before, I would say, you know, there are some places where I won't tell people just because of the nature of working in competitive intelligence. But there are some that I would just be hands down like, yeah, don't ever, you know, do an event for this company because they won't pay you, or they will underpay you while they've paid their male panelists more, or something like that. I think it is time. It is time to be held accountable. We need to stop being silently complicit.
I think that's I think that goes for so many things, and I think that's an incredibly powerful statement. So, and of course, you must not make the mistake of saying the silence is why it's perpetuated. The silence is what has given I guess companies and people the excuse to perpetuate it. It isn't the reason behind it. The reason behind it is lethargy and, you know, people wanting to keep power in the hands of, you know, the status quo. So I think, yeah, I think absolutely making sure that, you know, people know that they are going to get paid, in line with their peers in a company is massively important. I think, you know, making sure that we have the space to allow those voices to be heard when they say, well, actually, yeah, this is not right, is important. I think, you know, speaking up is always important in all of these environments. So, I really do think that, you know, that was a very passionate speech.
I
have no doubt you aren't, right? I have no doubt you aren't. But I mean, it is really important that, you know, that message just keeps getting sent through. Look, Suki, just as we start rounding up, you know, Nothing Venture is all about backing yourself, taking risks without having clear visibility of where it may take you. You're no stranger to this. You know, you've co-founded or launched Salaam Ventures, an accelerator for ethical startups, DC Analytics and Mirrorview. Does it get easier over time? And what are the core lessons you've learned when you've been launching something new?
I think the only thing that gets easier over time is if you have an idea, and I guess this is the whole part of putting on your blinders, is if you are really very hyper-focused on something and you know, you feel in your heart of hearts, in your head, in your heart, in your body and soul, you think, this will work, this is good. I'm a big fan of Adidas, and one of the things that always gets pushed out is, you know, your impossible is nothing. And for me, it's all that matters. If you don't try, you'll never know. And impossible is nothing, and that's basically it. You have nothing if you have not tried. And the same thing is impossible actually is the word I'm possible. And so I always think about that whenever on my wall in my bedroom, I have this saying, and it's be like Mike. And it is basically just saying, be like Michael Jordan. Although debatable as to whether or not he was actually the nicest person. However, it was the mindset and the work mentality. It is, you know, you show up early, you do what you have to do, but at the same time, as well as being like Mike, you have to take that part of being a human, being empathetic and realizing I have to take care of myself first, because you're no good if you're not taking care of yourself. You're rubbish for yourself and everybody else. And I think that's one of the things that first gets misunderstood and also ignored when people are starting out, is that sometimes you throw so much into it that you forget that, you know, you have to actually eat, breathe and sleep, and you need to eat and drink a lot of water and not just a lot of coffee. I don't do coffee, but I would say for people it is really to focus on. And I've said this for years, not just in the last few years, everybody's talking about mental health and, you know, mindset. I've said this for years. I've always said, been a firm believer in analyzing the analyst, making sure that you know your mindset. You are in the strongest place possible to do what you have to do. Because as an analyst, if you are not in a good place where you can recognize your own biases, your own mindset issues, your own environment, you're not going to be giving the best analytical input, or you're not going to be offering up the best analysis and best recommendations to people, because you have to recognize that in order to do the best thing possible. So take care of you first, but make sure if you have a good idea, don't get sidetracked by people that don't have your best interests. There is really a lot of reading other people. And I think that's probably one of the areas that's really a soft skill, quote unquote, of reading other people.
I think there are several things there that definitely resonate. I mean, the first is, you know, that concept of what is impossible. You have to put one foot in front of the other, right? I think a lot of people get very caught up when they're looking at building something, they envisage the end point and don't think about the first step. And they get absolutely overwhelmed by thinking about this massive endpoint that they're trying to get to, and therefore just don't even take that first step. And I think it's massively important that you realize that everything starts off with very small steps. And I think the second thing, that you said there around backing yourself, that I think for me is probably one of the learnings that I went when I started off as an entrepreneur, which was only sort of, 5, 6, 7 years ago, at the ripe old age of 36 or 37, I had not realized that actually up until that point, most of the voices in my life were holding me back, yeah, not pushing me forward. And I think it is really important for all of us to understand that we have our own agency, right? Like we are the agents of our own future. And if we don't take hold of that agency and we give it to someone else, then we can't complain about where life takes us. And look, obviously, I'm not suggesting that entrepreneurship is for everyone, but everyone can be an entrepreneur if they so choose in myriad ways, right? It doesn't matter whether that's, doing a baking on the weekends and selling cakes, or whether that's, having a side hustle in e-com alongside your day job. It has never been easier to be an entrepreneur. But I think I fully subscribe to everything you said there. I think, you've got to take those small steps and you've got to back yourself. And I think that's incredibly important. Suki, it's been absolutely amazing having you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me. For our listeners, where can they find you online? Are you on Twitter, on LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to come looking for you?
I would say the best place is LinkedIn. I don't tweet as much as I used to. I think that's probably healthy for me. But I would say the best place is LinkedIn, and it's just my name, Suki Fuller. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I do occasionally tweet and retweet things that I think are worthy. But all social media platforms are Suki Fuller, and just not Facebook. That's Facebook. I tell people there's an analogy I use. Facebook is sort of my home because that's where a lot of my family members are. So it's a very closed environment for me. And Twitter is like my backyard. And so because people can lob stuff over the fence, you can throw it back, but they're not in your house. So, and you, other people can be in your yard or whatever, in your garden, your backyard or whatever. And LinkedIn is my office. So, the response that you get there is going to be entirely different. And Instagram is just sort of like my playground because nobody ever posts bad things on Instagram that they do in their life. It's always the cherry picked. And although I do show the bad things, I'm a little bit too honest. I may not show them, but I definitely use the words. But I usually just show sort of my fitness workout. And if I'm having a bad day, you might see my face scrunched up or, might see me in much pain after workout. But that's pretty much the way that I use social media. It's very much me. So, yeah, I'm a little bit unfiltered, but it has to be that way. Although not entirely, you don't get 100% of the frustration and anger. You only get maybe about 90%. If you got 100%, you couldn't handle it. So,
well, I'm sure for our listeners, those that are listening to this podcast have certainly gotten a glimpse into the life of Suki. Suki, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always a pleasure to talk to friends that I really do like and enjoy speaking to. We always have some really great discussions. So thank you very much for having me, Ash.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.